and welcome to For the Love of Nature, a podcast where we tell you everything you need to know about nature and probably more than you wanted to know. I'm Laura.
And I'm Katie. And today we're going to be talking about viruses. And though they are technically non-living, viruses do have a huge impact on living organisms and their evolution.
Woo! It's an appropriate time to talk about this because of, I mean, not just the pandemic,
yeah, I was gonna say,
but also the time of year.
World turmoil for the last few years. It's fine.
They're a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah, tis the season. Tis the season, I guess.
Tis the season.
Oh, goodness. Well, can we do some nature news? Because I have some crazy nature news.
Yeah, hit me.
Crabs. Not the STD, the species. So Alaska has officially canceled snow crab season because officials are trying to investigate and figure out where the heck about a billion crabs have gone, which is insane.
How does one lose a billion anything?
I know, right?
Besides and plankton.
Yeah, right? And it's crabs, so just a billion gone.
And
so
snow crabs are not small crabs.
No, and they're only in a particular region in outside of Alaska anyway. So the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has, for the first time in state history ever, canceled the winter snow crab season in the Bering Strait due to their falling numbers. So if you like crab, don't expect to get that.
Like, it's that or they're just a billion off. Like, somebody is terrible.
Some intern has messed it up for years.
Terrible. Yeah.
Well, they're saying like an estimated 1 billion crabs have mysteriously disappeared in 2 years. So they have kind of watched it go down the last couple years, but it's like a billion.
But at once, yeah.
Yeah, but it marks a 90% drop in their population, which is, that's no good. So they're not sure. They have a few different guesses if because of, climate change, the article says, did they run up north to get to colder water? And I just imagine like a billion crabs running.
A billion.
Because they're, first of all, they're not going to be like running crabs on the ocean floor. I don't know. That's just funny.
Like a billion crabs, I feel like it'd make like an underwater, like a tidal wave.
You would think.
Just like billion crabs. You see a ripple. The surface from a billion crabs running.
Billion crabs running. I feel like that's like a song.
A song title.
Sort.
Absolutely. Yeah, billion, I thought the same
billion
thing.
Billion crabs running. They also don't know if the crabs have crossed the border. Are they Russian now? Did they walk off the continental shelf?
And then what happens to them?
I don't know. I guess star in their own role of Abyss 3? I don't know. I'm not sure. Because I said the same thing. I was like, okay, so if they fall off the shelf,
like, do they live?
Yeah.
They're swimming? They're just swimming
to Russia. Then you imagine, like, a billion crabs, and then all the fish down there are like, what the hell? Because it's just like a billion crabs. Everywhere. Oh, goodness. So, yeah, so they're looking, but But those crabs, that's really...
Or like just one giant suicide pact.
Yeah, of a billion crabs. That's why they went off the shelf. Just like, it's getting too warm. No one's listening to us. We've tried to tell them for years. Let's go, guys. And they're just like...
Can't take it.
But they do think that disease is a possibility, but they're really not sure. I mean, obviously because things are...
Crabs that got crabs.
Yeah. But so... Climate change, obviously, is what they're pointing at. I mean, we all know that our water is getting warmer, and it does not take... Everybody thinks that it takes... Oh, it's got to be 10 degrees.
Right, we're not boiling the crabs. Yeah. Okay.
It does not take much of a temperature difference for us to kill out an entire species. And so
think about it. Like, I mean, the difference between 72 and 74 in my own house is a lot.
It's a huge difference. Yeah, no, it definitely is.
Being comfortable and uncomfortable.
Yeah, and they've been recording that the Bering Strait has been getting warmer. And so that's why they're like, man, and there are, I mean, it's, they're cold water crabs. Like, they need that freezing cold water.
I can't even imagine the poor crabbers.
I know,
like,
right?
Like, that's a lot of money to lose an entire year of income.
Right? Yeah. So, yeah. Well, hopefully, I don't know, hopefully scientists
find
will
them.
Have... Yeah, just find... Has anyone seen a billion crabs? We're missing a billion crabs.
We need to put up, like, wanted posters, or missing crab posters.
Do we have any listeners in Alaska? I think we do.
Please, please send us, or please post
missing crabs. All right, hold on.
Have you seen these missing crabs?
Yeah. So, well, we need an Alaskan listener. Does anybody know any? Oh, wait, no. We have two. We have a few different people that live in Anchorage, Alaska. So if they are listening to this episode, because I can't see whenever what episodes they're listening to. But yes, we will help you make missing crabs. Missing crabs. Oh, goodness. Alrighty. So do we want to talk about viruses then?
Yeah, let's do it.
I mean, while we're on the subject of crabs.
Right, or diseases that might be wiping them out.
Yeah, we're going to bounce back and forth on this episode a little bit. Laura's going to give you a little bit of an overview of viruses, and I'm going to talk about different types, and then we're going to go back to Laura, and then after that, I'm going to talk about one, Laura will talk about a different one, of a virus that we picked that is affecting evolution.
Right, and that actually, I learned quite a bit about that part, and man, boy, did I have some serious flashbacks to AP Bio with this one. I specifically remember learning about, like, the bacteriophages and all that. Ugh. But anyway. Okay, so, overview of viruses. And so, if you all remember, Katie said that they're technically non-living. What are they, then? The term, the word virus comes from Latin for a slimy liquid or poison, which I think is cool. Slimy. And they weren't really actually studied until the 1890s, which I guess makes sense because it's not like you can see them.
Okay.
They're pretty small. And they are known as infectious. So they're an infectious, not organism, because they're not alive, like an infectious thing that infects plants, animals, and bacteria. They will infect things, and those things are called hosts. There's other things called vectors, which are like the middleman for viruses. Yeah, like from the virus, it carries the virus around and infects the host, like mosquitoes. Some are limited, like to specific species, and other ones have a wide range and can even jump from animals to humans and things like that. And once they have become infectious, so if they're just these things out there in the environment, they're just a virus. But as soon as they infect something, they're then called a virion, which actually I don't think I knew.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't remember ever.
Yeah, nobody ever talks about virions.
Yeah.
That's what
it is. Or, you know, the practical things that we need to know.
Virus is a benign thing. They are typically small and simple. Okay, well, they're always small. I guess it's relative of how small.
Yeah. But dear God, don't tell me they're big.
Thankfully. Yeah. And what makes them technically non-living is that they can only multiply in living cells. So they are not free living. This prevents them from being considered an organism. However, some of these viruses, as Katie, you might even talk about, get pretty, although they're called simple, some of them are pretty complex.
Yeah, and I have like a little bit about it. I don't go too into detail because I was just getting way too into the weeds.
Yeah, yeah. Some people are even wondering, inside of our cells, we have mitochondria, which could that have been? That can't live out on its own. Yeah. But is it considered living? I don't know. It depends on what you consider. All of these viruses contain either DNA or RNA. DNA is what makes us. It's like your blueprints, and RNA is kind of the same thing. And they also have proteins. However, they can't make their own proteins. So again, not free living. They have to use a living cell in order to do what they need to do. They also can't generate their own energy. They steal it from the cell that they're in.
Mine. Just give me.
I need this energy.
Yeah.
I mean, man, they figured it out. They don't need to do it themselves. And then they can make somebody else do it for them.
I mean, what's going on?
Yeah. Most have a capsid, or what's kind of like a shell, that protects the DNA and RNA and provides attachment points. So most of us are familiar at this point with what COVID looks like. The little symbol for it's everywhere. It's a little ball covered in spikes. And so sometimes those capsids, that shell, has things to attach with. And it usually also has the proteins that can be used to penetrate or inject the cell so that you can get in it or stick its stuff in there. And and as Katie will tell you, they come in several shapes and many sizes.
Do you just write these things and then just keep moving? Like, it doesn't...
Yeah. Well, because I write bullet points, and so they're very abbreviated. So then my mouth just says, I just say it.
This is why we're friends, folks. This is why we're friends.
I'm just a constant source of entertainment. So that's what a virus is. Real quick, what do they do? And then Katie will jump in.
Yep.
What do they do? Well, some might immediately cause cell death, which I just like that term, cell death. It sounds really intense. Yes. But not because it's, and more than just death, cell death.
Yeah.
Immediate cell death.
Yeah, because it doesn't kill the host, nothing. No, it's immediate cell death.
Cell death.
Just cell death.
So it can do that, or they can lie dormant. Sometimes their DNA or RNA is integrated into the host DNA, which I'm going to talk about this later too. But sometimes we like intermingle our DNA with viruses, and they hide their DNA in ours, and all of a sudden some stimulus will happen, like UV light, and then bam, they become, or stress. Yeah, stress is a lot of triggers. Stress is a big
one. Yeah.
Yeah. Some can cause cancer, which I actually also don't think I knew, but yeah. I mean, if I thought about it, I guess so, because they a lot of the human papillomavirus, herpes, that can lead to cancer and things. Most viruses don't cause disease, but some do. And those diseases can either be acute, meaning like just short-lived, or chronic and last forever. So some are the gift that keep on giving, and some will just be here and gone. And most of them won't even make you sick, which I think is pretty cool.
I guess. I don't know if I would still want a virus.
No, you're right. Okay, yeah. So maybe not cool, but...
I can manage.
Like eyelash mites. You're like, eh.
No, I do don't mind really, that one. But...
So that is what a virus is, and that's what they do.
Okay, so I'm going to go over then the three... Okay, so here we go. I'm going to talk about the three
types.
This is
just like my taxonomic crisis of norm.
It just... They really attempt to make it simple, but it's not. So to keep it simple for our nature novices listeners, I'm going to first give you three different types, and we broke it down by morphology, and then I'm going to give you the scientific way of how they break it down. So... Morphology, like I said, we're going to break it down by the three different types of morphology, is just the form or shape of the living organism. That's really all it is. And the relationship between the structures. The three basic ones are helical, isometric, and complex viruses. Because most viruses probably evolved from different ancestors, the systematic methods that scientists have used to classify the different types of viruses are... The classic way that we use to classify plants and animals cannot work viruses. Yeah,
of course.
It just can't work that way.
But I'm sure it's constantly changing too.
Oh, it is. Yeah, and that just gives us like a ton of different ways to categorize these stupid things. Of course. Because nothing in science can be ever be easy.
Definitely ever. Not when it comes to classification. Yeah,
no. But at least that gives us a lot of content because everything's always changing.
Very true.
So the helical is the shape of the virus, is a spiral shape that curves cylindrically around an axis. Like a
spring.
Yeah. In the case of the helical virus, the viral nucleic acid coils into the helical shape, and the capsid, what Laura was talking about before, proteins wind around the inside or outside of the nucleic acid, forming a long tube or rod-like structure. And so, yeah, it'll go up, but it's a tube. So like Laura said, spring.
And nucleic acids, that's the DNA RNA.
Yes, for those who don't know. Helical viruses can be enveloped or naked. And so what's an envelope? A viral,
Those naked viruses.
But a virus envelope is just the outermost layer of many types of viruses. It protects the genetic material and their life cycle when traveling between host cells. Not all viruses, like I said, have envelopes. Some are, in fact, naked. One of these viruses that has the envelope is the tobacco mosaic virus. which is a naked.
That sounds beautiful.
Or sorry. This one is a naked helical virus, but it only, you were talking before about how some viruses only affect certain things. This is one that it can affect other plants, but that is very rare. It pretty much goes after tobacco plants, and it makes their leaves look like a mosaic. Well, not all for the tobacco plant.
Well,
most plant viruses are helical, and it is very uncommon that a helical plant virus is enveloped. In contrast, all
naked
helical
plants. Interesting.
Naked plants, yeah. In contrast, all helical animal viruses are enveloped. For example, let's see here. Some are like the influenza virus, measles virus, mumps, rabies, and Ebola. Which it does make sense why a plant wouldn't need an envelope and animals would, because it's like it is a way harsher environment. You figure
in an animal, an animal cells, everything trying to kill it.
Yeah, everything's trying to kill it and attack it, and a plant's just like, welcome. Come on in.
Or like, cause do plants have immune systems?
Not in the same way we do.
Not in the same way. Yeah.
So animals or viruses that are attacking animals, they do have to be a lot tougher to be able to survive. So being helical, there are several perceived advantages to forming that particular shape. First, only one type of capsid protein is required. Because only one is required, that subunit is repeated over and over and over again to form the capsid. And this structure is so simple, it means it doesn't really require a whole lot of energy to assemble than a capsid made up of multiple proteins. So super easy.
Yeah.
In addition to the simplicity, having only one nucleic capsid protein means that only one gene is required instead of several. Again, it reduces the length of it and the nucleic acid that's required to make it. So doesn't really need a whole lot. Because the helical structure can continue indefinitely, there is also no constraints on how much nucleic acid can be packaged into the viron. So the capsid length will be the size of the coiled nucleic acid. So it's so simple, it's easy to do. However long it needs to be can be that long. All right.
They just do not. They're just like, whatever.
Yeah, I'm just going to keep it. Okay, thank you. Bye. The second morphology or shape of viruses I want to talk about is isometric viruses. These are by far the most prevalent viruses out there.
Which is funny that it's not the simplest ones that are the most prevalent. You'd think like...
So this one is simple, but for a very different reason.
Okay.
So isometric viruses are roughly sort of spherical, and it's in the sphere that the genome of the virus lives. Although, for simplicity's sake, a lot of people say that they're spherical. They're really, and this is going to be the nerdiest thing that I've ever said, but the only reason why I know about this is because of Laura freaking. But icosahedral means 20 sides, so it's like a 20-sided die.
That's amazing. Yeah.
So that's what these viruses are. So a long time ago, whenever we started looking at them, they're like, oh, it's a sphere, so they're spherical. And then whenever we got new technology, can really zoom in and see them, they're like,
you can see facets.
They're like, no, it is not, actually. And I don't want to go into too much of the detail, but there are aspects of the isometric viruses that divide them into further, which are called twofold, threefold, or fivefold axis groups. But it all has to do with if you take a pencil and stick it down through one of the points, how it'll come out like another point. And depending on where those, like each of those little flat sides.
Yeah.
Is like another like piece to the puzzle. So it needs all those 20 sides for the complexity of it. But it's also each like its own individual thing. It's fascinating. Huh. But I'm not going to go into that here because it does get into some really deep science. But isometric viruses, if you want to look into it further, it is actually really, really cool. So why does this, the isohedral, whatever it is, 20-side structure appear so often? Research has shown that proteins which form the 20-side symmetry require lesser amounts of energy compared to other structures, even less than the helical. And so this structure is evolutionary favored. It's because all it is like, whereas the helical has to build like the whole capsule and then helical it up, make it a spring. Technically, this one, it's my understanding that it's like each one of those sides, so it just has to replicate a side and then it has to replicate a side. And so they're like, that's what I'm saying. Like they're individual, but they're also all together. Okay. So whenever you're making it, quote unquote, you're only really making a side. And then like your job is like their job is done. And then another group, quote unquote, comes in and makes that other side. Then they're kind of done. I don't know how else really to explain it. But anyway, so many of the viruses that infect animals are this isometric, including HPV, a rhinovirus, hepatitis B, and the herpes viruses. Unlike helical, isohedral viruses can be naked or envelope as well. Did I say unlike helical or like helical? Like helical. Both be naked or envelope. The third type is a complex virus, and these viruses have just pretty much gone rogue.
I know, I just like how it's like, okay, this shape, and all the other ones.
Yeah, just, yeah, whatever else these guys want to do, let's just lump them all together because I think they're call just tired. Call them complex. Yeah, call them complex because none of it makes sense. So their architecture is not strictly conformed to either the helical or isohedral shape. Pox viruses, gemminiviruses, and many other bacteriophages are examples of viruses with complex structures. Pox viruses, including the viruses that cause smallpox or cowpox, are large oval or brick-shaped particles. And something, I was reading something about, like, they also have dumbbell-shaped things in them, too. Huh. Like, they're just, like, multi-shapes, different shapes, all combined. The Gemini viruses also exhibit complex structure. As their name suggests, these plant-infecting viruses are composed of two of the isometric heads joined together. So, all right. So while we can talk about their morphology as a simple way to divide up the viruses, there's also, of course, a more official approach since there are so many different characteristics. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to jump in. What's the, and are you, the, not,
There is the pox viruses and then the Gemini viruses?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I looked up a picture. I see what you're saying about the pox one. But what's, it's before AIDS. What's the thing that leads to AIDS?
HIV.
HIV, right. Yeah. HIV is one of the bacteriophages. Is that what that one is? Right? The,
No, I don't. Because there's think so.
are those also the ones that are considered complex, where they look like a little dart, or are they retro?
They keep saying that it's complex, but I don't know if they mean structurally or if they're just saying it is complex.
Right, right.
You know, we'll keep looking for it though, because it looks like it's saying the composed of two strands of RNA is packaged inside a distinctive cone shaped capsid, which protects the RNA. Yeah, so it would have to if it's cone shaped.
Yeah,
so it would have to be. Yeah, it would have to be.
Yeah, 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 I can see it. But yeah, where's the little, like, where does it have its little stalk? What's the.
It doesn't have to. Not all of them do.
No, yeah. So they've got these, like, they can be all these different shapes, but is it only complex that can have them?
I don't think so.
Okay, I was just wondering.
I can't imagine the helical having them, but I definitely know the isometric. Viruses definitely have them.
Yeah. Okay, sorry. I know that was it. It's a, that, the phage shape is so weird, but I wasn't sure if that was considered a grouping.
No, because they can.
Separate thing.
No. Yeah, because it can, bacteriophages, the phage part itself, can be on, like, a different head. So gotcha. It can either be in complex. I don't remember ever seeing one that was on helical. That would look kind of weird, but isometric for sure.
Gotcha.
Okay, so besides morphology then, the other way that we can divide these up is like we were talking about earlier, which is the more of like the classification taxonomy that you would see normally. And so this is like the more official way of how scientists narrow it down. And they group them. There's seven different groups. Well, let me first start by saying this. There was one classification system that was developed in the 1970s by a man named David Baltimore. He was a Nobel laureate, so, I mean, I guess he knows who he's talking about.
Smart guy.
So, because he developed it, they named it after him. I mean, fair enough. The Baltimore classification system categorizes viruses based on the type of nucleic acid genome and replication strategy of the virus. So the Baltimore classification system has seven different classes to divide viruses into. There are a variety of ways by which the viruses can be classified. However, including the viron size, capsid structure, type of nucleic acid, physical properties, which you kind of talked about, the host species, or the disease that it's caused. And because everything else that scientific classification does is so freaking difficult, they decided to form in, I think it was the mid-60s, the International Committee on Taxonomy of Viruses, the ICTV.
Nice.
Which is basically probably a group of just, I don't know, people who really get excited about virus shapes.
Virologists, I assume.
Yeah, just get really excited. But they help divide it, and by watching how these are grouping, a lot of it we can see small changes over time within the viruses and things like COVID, how you keep hearing all the different strands that are coming out and how it's evolving. This is how we're able to keep track of it, because they can see from one jump to the next, to the next, to the next, all in one grouping. And so that's pretty much the Baltimore classification. So okay. You have the morphology that we talked about, the three main groups. There are plenty more that you can break it down into, but that keeps it simple. And then the Baltimore classification, which is like the actual way to classify things.
Gotcha. So we talked about what is a virus, what they do, how you can categorize them. Once a virus infects someone, it starts to go through what is called the cycle of infection. This cycle is not true for all viruses, but it is true for most of them. So the first thing that happens is what's called adsorption, where a parental virus or virion attaches to a cell in some way, whether, you know, it attaches. Then it either penetrates or injects, depending on the type of virus. Then the nucleic acids, which is the DNA, RNA, get free. It attaches, it gets inside, it unravels its DNA or RNA and starts doing what it needs to do, which is translation and transcription. So it's translating its DNA. It's transcribing it, meaning it's building new stuff. Then it starts replicating itself. Then it puts all those pieces together in assembly, and then boom, release. So that's the cycle of infection. Like I said, not all of them do that, but most of them do. So in order to prevent or treat viruses, you have to disrupt the cycle of infection somewhere. Easiest thing to do is just to prevent them from happening.
Yeah, just to stop it altogether, you know.
Don't even let the cycle start. And that's just through things like hygiene. Whether it's your own hygiene or clean water,
yeah,
clean and things
surfaces,
like that.
Yeah.
Just cleanliness. Get rid of those viruses.
COVID has been horrible. My grandfather died from COVID, but I will say I have never loved flying more than I did during COVID, because I was, prior to COVID, one of those people that sit down and wipe everything down because
yes.
Airports are so disgusting. And it finally took COVID for airports and airlines to be like, hey, we should maybe be a little bit cleaner.
Yeah.
And they finally did it. So yeah, it doesn't take much. I mean, it does not take much.
Just a few steps
yeah.
to keep hygiene. Then prevention also is vaccines. Of course, not all viruses, we haven't developed vaccines for all of them, but we've developed vaccines for a lot of them. And there could be a whole episode on just vaccinations and how they work
yeah.
and all that stuff, because there's a lot of misconceptions about them all. But in general, a vaccine helps to prevent and or mitigate the effects of a virus. So it doesn't mean that you
yes.
might never get the thing.
It just makes it a little bit easier for you to fight it.
Yes. And then,
speaking of, I got to get my COVID, that booster again.
I just got mine.
I need to get my other one.
But it can lead to, someday, the elimination of the virus. So there are some viruses that, because so many people were vaccinated and it prevented it from mutating, and it eventually ran its course kind of thing. Right. Polio.
Yep.
Smallpox. A couple of other things like that.
You know, science doing its science thing.
Yeah. And then
shocking as it is.
If you do get a virus, antibiotics aren't going to do it, because antibiotics are against bacteria.
Yep.
So the only thing that can be done once you have it, other than just ride that sucker out, is that they have started to develop more antiviral meds. And this, that is just preventing one of these steps. So it's disrupting the cycle. It's disrupting replication, or it's disrupting assembly, or something like that they've developed, where at some point it's not letting the cycle continue on. So it's not getting rid of what's already in you. It's preventing it from becoming more and more and more.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's viruses that's in a nutshell.
Okay. Do you want to go first, or do you want me to go first for our one that we've chosen?
I think let me go first if you don't mind, because I think mine will set the stage for you. So we said that viruses have a huge impact on living organisms and their evolution. Just because they're not alive doesn't mean that they're not changing the planet.
That seems to be a t-shirt quote. Just because you're not alive does not mean you're not changing the world. and then just have like a tiny little bacteria, like a bacteriophage.
Not a bacteria, because those are alive.
No, the bacteriophage is like a little, like a really cartoonified one that just says like around it in like really bubbly font. Just because you're not alive doesn't mean you're not changing the world. That'd be amazing.
I imagine it like the little DNA guy from Jurassic Park.
Oh, yeah.
Like that kind of cartoony.
Right?
So viruses can do that in a couple of ways, change the world and affect evolution. The most straightforward one is just, they just kill off populations. The population, the survival of the fittest. Only certain traits are making it through. But that's the easy way they're affecting evolution. I want to talk about the way that they have changed evolution with their own DNA. So what I'm going to talk about is not one specific virus. It's a group of viruses called endogenous retroviruses, in particular, human endogenous retroviruses. All right, kids, settle down and listen to my story, because it's such a big word. So viruses likely came from cells, okay? Cells did not evolve from viruses. Viruses probably evolved from cells and are rogue nucleic acids. At some point, they just felt
decided to do their own thing.
Yeah.
Could you imagine being the first one? I don't need to be here anymore. I don't need to do this anymore.
This is way too much work. I'm just going to go find someone else to do this for me.
Yeah.
So once they developed, they started infecting things. And over the last 100 million years, humans and all of our ancestors, so all of the other primate lineage and probably even before then, have been infected with countless viruses. And those viruses have actually left what was kind of like a scar in our DNA. So scientists have discovered that human DNA is actually about 8% viral DNA.
Of course we are. We're just viruses. A walking virus.
We are walking viruses. I'm having deja vu. Here we go, Laura. Have we not talked about this again?
Wait, what?
Didn't we talk about this before? Oh, that we're walking. We said before that we were a walking bacteria. Right?
Yeah, and now we're just...
Now we're just walking viruses.
We're not human. We're just bacteria and viruses.
Bacteria and
viruses.
Running
around.
8% at the very least. And an 8% means about 22 families of viral, like, gene things are in the human genome.
Of course.
How do they know that? What did it do? Well, some of the viruses left behind their DNA. So if you remember what I said, sometimes our DNA can get, like, intermingled.
Twisted.
Because the whole point of this virus is it's sticking its own DNA in ours so that our cell is like, okay, I always imagine the cell is like a tiny little, very much like Osmosis Jones. It's everything's alive in it, okay?
Yeah.
So somebody is just doing their job, head down, just typing out, whatever they're reading.
I need to get up till 5 o'clock and then I can go home.
Yeah. So they're just making whatever the DNA says to make, whether it's, they don't recognize it, it's not our own stuff.
It's viruses.
They're just doing it. Well, sometimes then the virus is supposed to pull its stuff back out, but it doesn't always do that. Sometimes it leaves stuff in. Sometimes it takes more than it should. Sometimes there's just different things that can happen. In general, sometimes we then intermingle with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Hence the kind of like the scar that is left behind. And some of that DNA found its way into sperm and egg cells and can become part of a permanent species' genome, like it did for us. And they were like, okay, well, how do we know that this is like viral DNA and not just some weird, fluky, weird DNA. Just of course went in and they like switched something on in that segment.
All of a sudden
it started like producing live viruses of some extinct virus that, you know, hasn't been around.
Okay, we have talked about this before, guys.
Listen, do not stop stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah, it's like whenever they found the stuff in the ice in the Antarctic. Just don't do that. We should know better by now.
Even if you're like, I don't care to prove a point or not, man. That is terrifying. Yeah. There is nothing like so.
One slip or one sneeze, and then suddenly that's broken. It? And then, the whole world has it.
So they did. They were like, okay, yes, this is extinct viral DNA. I don't know how they turned it off again, but whatever.
Yeah, right. They're like, I don't know how to do it either.
We're in a volcano.
Yeah.
So.
I just picture like this tiny little scientist with a petri dish out in front of him, like, ah! Up to the top of a volcano, just chucks it in there, runs back down.
Abort.
Close, guys. That was close.
Yeah. So that's how it's gotten into our DNA. How does that affect evolution? Well, because everything we are is DNA. One of the things that they
really thought we were going to get it through an episode without having a mental crisis.
Yeah, these deep science ones are always a lot. So they compared this whole viral DNA shenanigans probably led to the differentiation of species. So they compared human and chimp DNA, and of course we're super duper similar. Well, we have the same scars, I'm doing air quotes here, in our DNA as chimpanzees do.
Which makes sense, yeah.
Most of them, okay?
Yeah.
So they're called insertion points. These mm-hmm. insertion points where the viral DNA shows up. So there are 10 million possible insertion points within DNA, okay?
Which I feel like is a little excessive, but continue.
There's just a lot of it.
Yeah.
So the fact that we share something, so many points with chimpanzees, the chances of that being coincidence are 1 in 5.88 times 10 to the 1,418th power.
That's insane. That number shouldn't even exist.
No, like, yeah. It couldn't possibly be a coincidence. Yeah. Therefore, it shows a common ancestor in evolution. So this is the whole, like, because before we believed in, like, the diverging thing, people believed, okay, like, chimps were from the beginning, humans were from the beginning.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Like, this shows, at some point, we were belonged together. And so this DNA, all of this changing DNA from all these viruses could have led to that happening. And then one last honorable mention about how these human endogenous retroviruses have changed us. They've actually found that there's this protein called syncytin, which is produced by viruses and is found in the human placenta. And they're pretty sure that at some point, some crazy mammal ancestor got infected with something, the DNA got left behind, and then they started having placentas. Like, the only reason
why like becoming today? A placenta.
A mammal. The fact that we can even have babies via placenta probably is something from a virus that we got.
This is just, again, this is... We just have, like, mites in our eyebrows, bacteria all over us, and now we're just walking viruses. It's fine, guys. We're not humans. We're just here for the viruses. It's fine, guys.
All right. What's your virus?
Good grief. So I'm going to take a little bit of a different spin on it, and I'm going to talk about avian flu. And, Laura, you did mention...
And I'm going to talk about avian flu.
Yeah. Try to make a positive
spice
here.
Spice it up a little.
Millions of birds are dying, folks. So, just as Laura mentioned about how sometimes it can just be parts of populations just killing over, let me tell you about the avian flu. So, the avian flu is a helical virus. It's often spread by contact between infected, typically wild birds, first, and healthy birds, though it can be spread indirectly through contaminated equipment. Again, keep your crap clean. And we said typically wild birds only because like your domestic, for the most part, your domestic birds aren't going to be like, I don't know, traveling. And so the wild birds migrate. And so that just leaves a wake of flu in its path.
A wake of flu.
Yeah, right. So the virus is found in secretions from the nostrils, mouth, eyes of infected birds, as well as their droppings. If you were just like getting it from a goose eye booger, like that probably wouldn't be a big of a deal, but because they poop everywhere.
So much.
Everywhere. Every, what, 5 minutes or so? It's just something a ridiculous like amount. All right, so symptoms for the bird of avian flu depend, of course, on the bird itself, but it could be anything from purple, like a chicken, because I know a lot of our chickens are being wiped out by avian flu right now here in the U.S., but like their wattles, combs, legs can turn purple. They can have really bad diarrhea, nasal discharge, soft shelled or misshapen eggs, drastic decrease in egg production, coughing and sneezing, lack of coordination, swelling of the head, eyelids, wattles, combs, for as far as chickens go, lack of energy and appetite, pinpoint hemorrhages in the feet and legs. It could mess up with their feathers. And the major warning sign to watch out for is they will just die. Birds, typically, they hide their symptoms until death. Yeah. They do not. And I know everybody says it's like for an evolution purpose to survive so they don't appear weak in the wild. And I really don't know if it's that or they're just like not smart enough to know that they're sick. Because I've met, you know, some pretty dumb birds. Yeah. But a lot of them will just, they could be like have sniffles and you're never going to know it because they're going to hide it. And then that's why they just end up dying. And when I say dying, it can wipe out a whole poultry chicken coop. Yeah. In a couple days, like all gone. So to prevent spreading when you're around birds, you have to disinfect shoes, clothes, hands, egg trays, anything, like if you're collecting eggs for chickens, any sort of cleaning materials, anything if you're driving through an area with the birds. I mean, you just have to really be diligent on cleaning.
I know that they order, like, recently. I mean, if one bird ends up getting it, they have to kill all the birds.
Yeah. Yep. Because it's gonna go through it and then...
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's not only going to, and the reason for the culling is not only because it's gonna wipe them out probably anyway, but if those birds' droppings, if one wild bird, a healthy wild bird, even remotely gets close to it, boom, that wild bird catches it and then off it
takes
goes
it
again.
To the next farm. Yeah.
Yep. So the avian origin influenza viruses that you're gonna hear me refer here and there about H something N something, and to explain that, so all of the bird flus that we're talking about, there's influenza A, B, C, I think there was D, I don't remember, but all the ones that we're talking about are influenza A, and they have the H is the hemagglutinin or H proteins, and there are 16 different ones, and then the neuramidases, or N proteins, and there are 9. So as many different combinations of H and N proteins that are possible. So there's 16 different H's and 9 different N's, and then however many different combinations, that's how what you get. All right, so let's cover a little bit about the history of avian flu so we can see where this is going. And this is going to just be real quick here. It was first recorded in northern Italy in 1878 by a veterinarian, it's Edoardo Pranaccio. Go for it. He started to notice some sort of contagious respiratory disease that was spreading among poultry, and it just like high fatality rate. And he's a vet. He's going around. He's seeing all this stuff. Which now that I think about it, he was probably the one spreading it.
Probably.
But he didn't even know. So for almost 100 years, though, they thought that what this guy was seeing was bird cholera. And But it wasn't until 1981 it was officially renamed and proven to be the highly pathogenic avian influenza, or HPAI, which there is an important difference between highly pathogenic avian influenza, HPAI. And then because on the flip side, there's the LPAI, which is low. So you have high and low.
Oh, okay.
HPAI continued to spread globally through the 1920s with sporadic outbreaks occurring. Several of these outbreaks occurred in the U.S. from 1959 to 1995, but they were sporadic, like you'd hear about it in the news or whatever, yeah. Go away, hear about it, you know, not anything crazy. Emergence of the avian flu across the world was reported on 15 separate occasions. All infections were caused by the influenza A virus, but the subtypes vary between H5 and the H7 groups. In 1996, a new strain of avian flu, subtype H5N1, was introduced to poultry via migratory waterfowl in the Guangdong province of China. This resulted in a mortality of greater than 40% of the aquatic birds.
Whoa.
Which is so many birds. So many dead birds. And so this was sort of like the first one that we had recorded that was in 96 that was just like, whoa, this is a ton of birds that just died. Subsequent events between HPAI and then the LPAI led to a new HPAI. Because you know how Laura was talking about how they intermingle? Like, we humans, I'll get into this in a second. Like, we can get these, but this is one of the ones that, because there's so many different combinations, it rapidly evolves and changes and morphs and adapts. So this all led to a new HPAI strain that in 1997 in Hong Kong resulted in the culling of the entire poultry population. Hong Kong was just like, you know what? We're going to stop this right here. Boom. Kill them all. And so, wham, whole poultry population gone. And during this, 18 human infections and 6 human deaths were also seen in Hong Kong. So this is also sort of like the first time that we'd seen reported deaths before, but now it's okay. This isn't like one fluke. This isn't like just a chicken farmer. This is like, we're starting to see some numbers here. And they didn't think that it was really possible before 97. So after the outbreak of the HPAI in Hong Kong, evidence of HPAI seemed to taper off from 1997 until 2003 when 2 humans were diagnosed with H5N1, which is one we frequently heard about, after returning from China. From 2003 to 2018, human cases were reported from 16 countries, resulting in hundreds of deaths now from people getting this H5N1 from birds. Because again, it's adapted, the virus has figured it out. Okay, this isn't killing off my host.
Plus, when things jump from species to species, the new species has zero capability of dealing with it because we never have before.
The pandemic risk associated with HPAI is insanely high. The combination of rapid mutations in the H and the N strains and the increased risk of HPAI spillover from poultry to humans is cause for significant concern. And I've seen this on like several different websites that people are like, listen, we should probably be looking into avian flu a little bit more than what we are. This could be like the next pandemic level. H5N1 HPAI was replaced then by the H5N6 and H5N8 subtypes from 2014 to 2020. Then in 2021, H5N1 emerged again and seemed to be just came back and what decided that, you know what, I left for a little bit, but I'm here to stay. And since early 21, H5N1 has been the one that has been responsible for the outbreaks that has effectively wiped out any other like H5 HPAI viruses. Like for whatever reason, H5N1 is this is my area now.
Yeah.
And so while the reason isn't entirely sure, it is believed that the explosion of cases is due to the introduce and spread of the virus by migratory birds, which I know like whenever Laura and I were in the zoos and we had avian flu here in the States really bad, like we had to take all sorts of extra precautions for birds within zoos during migratory seasons because you get one infected bird dropping and then it can infect your bird.
Yeah. It hit the East Coast here a couple months ago.
They said in the U.S. alone, the current outbreak for this year of the H5N1 has led to the death of over 37 million poultry.
Yeah. It hit the East Coast, like Jersey and Eastern Maryland a little bit, but New Jersey a lot. And a lot of us pulled our birds inside. Like,
yeah.
we didn't let our owl out for a while and like stuff like that.
Because it doesn't really take much.
I knew it was really an issue because I have to get frozen chicks for the owl to eat.
Uh-huh.
Astronomical price increase. Three times as expensive as normal.
That's crazy.
Because they were like they had to cull so many chickens.
Yeah, dang. Well, so what does this all mean for the future of birds? So let's just think about it. We've talked about
humans,
birds.
Yeah.
Yeah, and humans. So we've talked about birds quite often in a lot of different episodes. So first off, what does this mean? If my 6-year-old doesn't get his chicken nuggies, all hell's going to break loose, first of all.
for most kids, I think.
And I really think that the only thing that would be worse than no chicken nuggets for him would be there's no more ketchup. That might be the only other thing that would tip it over. So food. But like food, if we don't have chicken and poultry, do you realize how much like chicken Americans eat?
We consume? Yeah.
So much chicken in so many different forms. So it would be a complete devastation to the poultry industry, which is, yes, there are huge, big brand name companies, but there are a lot of farmers and individuals who rely on poultry farming or even like local little urban farms that have chickens and things. And so that is a significant loss of money for families. Wild bird deaths, though, think of all the different pollinators that we have out there of different bird species.
Yeah.
And they start wiping out and they start getting lower in numbers. There's tons of different plants, trees and stuff that just, nope, we're not going to have them anymore because birds play a huge role in pollination of them. Rodent control. Imagine all the mice that we have. We don't have any birds of prey left. And again, the more the flu virus mutates, the easier it has been spreading to humans. Yeah. And it has been jumping. And the more, now it's the H5N1. That's been jumping, but as it continues to jump and evolve, it's just going to get worse and worse. And so we're just going to start seeing it in humans more and more. And so, so they're saying that this is the one to watch out for. If we're going to have another pandemic, like they're saying that it's the avian flu is going to be the one that's going to hit us. So,
on that wonderful note, jeez.
Listen, it is fascinating, but it's like one of those like
terrifying.
Terrifying. You should probably watch the news. If you hear avian flu, don't just be like, rah, it's the birds. No, it's humans too.
Well, I guess it's at least a good incentive for different poultry practices. Like,
hopefully,
maybe we shouldn't have them all packed in together so tight. And you know what I mean? Like some hygiene.
Well, not only that but like it's like even these small farmers that let their chickens free range, they're the ones that are probably going to get it faster just because they're out and about with wild birds and stuff. So it's like, it's just like a detrimental thing that it's just going to keep wiping out populations until like you said, like with yours, with the virus or the, let's say the antivirals and stuff you could do, there's that break, that split. But for these guys, it's just like, there just needs to be a point where we got to stop it. And that's why they keep culling populations of birds and hoping that one of those will be the split that it needs. But doesn't seem like it so far. Right? Second pandemic, woohoo! We're millennials. We're numb to any kind of world chaos at this point anyway, so it's fine.
Yeah.
You heard it here, folks.
And just, I guess, to end it so that people aren't just, oh my freaking gosh. I mean, it's fall, we're all getting sick, but just remember,
wash your hands.
Well, wash your freaking hands. Cover your mouth. All the things. And but that most viruses don't even cause disease.
Yeah, so, most of them don't. It's just we got to keep ourselves clean from the ones that do. Just
those few, yeah.
Just those few that happen to be very bad. Well, on that note, guys. Viruses. All right. Go ahead and check us out on Patreon and connect with us on Twitter. And let us know if you guys have any episode ideas, because we're going to be coming up on the end of this one and Kim's going to have a break. I don't know if Kim has any ideas for the season break yet, though, but if you guys have any ideas for Kim to go over this time, make sure you send them our way. Until then, we will talk to you guys next week.
Bye.